You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
According to Barfoot and Thompson, the average rent price for Auckland Central has reached $513 per week. If you remain the representative for Auckland Central, how will you ensure that residents here have a stable and affordable place to live?
Really good question, because it happens that Auckland Central also has the highest proportion of renters in the entire country. So the average across the nation is 30%, where in Auckland Central we know that it's more than half of my constituents. So we know that the healthy home standards are important, but they're not being enforced properly, and they disproportionately require the tenant to raise an issue, which then brings into effect the power imbalance that we see between property managers, landlords and their tenants. So to fix that, we need a rental warrant of fitness, which would work really efficiently in tandem with the register for property managers and landlords, because right now there is no barrier to entry for being somebody who runs a property that somebody rents out and lives in. There is no qualification. There is no bar beyond having the capital necessary to get in there. So this would work in the same way that we've seen them operate in the UK, where bad actors and bad apples that we hear tend to be the one-off cases as far as the media reporting goes, well, that they're weeded out and they're not able to continue offending like that. But as far as affordability goes, that would also work with rent controls. And here I need to be really explicit, because it is something that I don't think we've spent anywhere near enough time working through the economics on or the kind of evidence base for. International evidence tells us that rent controls work effectively to control rents. Where they are implemented in jurisdictions where geographically proximate to them, they don't have rent controls, we see that there is a lift up in rents outside of those rent controlled areas. So what that says is there's actually an argument for universalisation of rent controls. We actually already have forms of rent controls under the Residential Tenancies Act, that being that you cannot increase rents more than once per annum, and also that rents are set at what is called market rate. The problem is that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So we've said as the Greens that we want to introduce some rationale and predictability to what those rental increases would be by no more than 3% per annum. And of course there are movements around that if, for example, you were to massively and substantially increase the quality of the property.
Yeah, and your policy so far on regulations to help renters has been quite a success, and you got rated an A by Renters United. On the flip side of that, though, the other side of Parliament and political parties are saying that these kind of regulations will disincentivize landlords, and it's quite something you hear all the time.
I'm really keen to dig into that.
So yeah, I'd love to hear from your point of view. Are those valid concerns that will disincentivize landlords and then make rent higher because it decreases supply?
No National or ACT Party MP or candidate can look you straight in the eye and tell you that if they were to strip away those protections that we've fought tooth and nail for over the last 5 years, if they were to strip those away, that rents would reduce. They can't do that because they won't. And the reality is that if you're talking about the cost of rentals, for example, or even the cost of housing, prior to the pandemic, we had some of the most fortuitous economic circumstances for those who had speculated on property or owned property over the past 10 plus years, and the OCR and therefore mortgage rates were looking like they were nearing or getting towards zero. And we didn't see rents go down. In fact, we saw the opposite of it. Rents continued to escalate. We saw that when the rent freeze came off the back of the COVID-19 interventions and measures, that rents skyrocketed thereafter. So what we know is that rents are currently set at the maximum of what the market will bear. They don't really hold any other rationality or impetus behind them other than that. A house also does not disappear when it is sold by a landlord to, for example, a first home buyer. And I would also make the point that there is a far bigger economic question here, which was actually reflected in the High Wealth Individuals report from IRD and subsidiary papers from Treasury released at the beginning of this year, which told us not only about the state of inequality in this country, but also that we have disproportionate incentives by virtue of the way that our tax system is designed to see capital flow into housing, that not only bids up house prices, but it also means that we end up seeing the costs to innovation, to employment, to small businesses and the productive economy. Because when you see money and capital flowing into the unproductive economy, i.e. to speculating on houses that already exist, then that comes at the expense of all of us. So ultimately, we're saying we need to change those fundamental incentives. And that's, you know, we could talk about the wealth tax and other interventions there, but also that, I'm sorry, a bottom line for me is that we treat housing as a human right, not as a commodity to gamble on. And research out of this very university, the University of Auckland, tells us that 95% of investments in rental properties do not make sense on rental yield alone, i.e. landlords are not making the rational economic decision to buy their properties for sake of the returns that they'll get on rent, but because of the capital gains that they will make as a result. All of that feeds this frenzy which bids up those house prices, and only the Greens are willing to say house prices need to come down, and these are the interventions that we're willing to put up to do that.
Yeah, and I guess I also want to pivot because alongside housing, in a city that's movable and productive, you need public transport.
Oh, yeah.
So I did want to touch on that, and I wanted to ask what your priorities are around public transport and what kind of infrastructure we can see if you are elected back into this office. How will you make Auckland more efficient?
So first things first, we need to do better with the things that we've already got. And I'd say this not only with our roading network, but also actually if you were to think about some of the vacant spaces within the central city that could be outer spaces or performing spaces or filled with small businesses for peppercorn rent and short-term leases. And I've been lobbying Eke Panuku, a council-controlled organisation charged with empowering the city centre master plan to get on with this. But we'll put that aside for now. One of the most efficient things that we could do is reallocation of road space. So you think about any city internationally where the community is flourishing, where you see small businesses cropping up and it's an awesome place to actually hang out because there's cafes and there's hospitality and there's venues and there's stuff happening and people want to meander and hang around. Well, those are places that are built around people. They're not built around the private vehicle. And it blows my mind how here in Aotearoa, but particularly in Tāmaki Makaurau, that we seem to have this really peculiar exceptionalism that, I don't know, seems to be borne by talkback radio hosts or, you know, the majority of particularly the legacy political parties, that apparently the interventions that have worked really, really well across cities everywhere in the world, regardless of cultural differences, are somehow not going to work here. So long story short, it looks like more pedestrianisation. It looks like more walking and more cycleways. It looks like more occupation of spaces by our small businesses, putting chairs and, you know, activating those public spaces.
Actually, I want to ask a question about light rail because I think that's a really important subject matter. So you'd want to see light rail brought
above ground. Yep.
Currently it's planned to go underground.
Currently it's proposed to go below ground at an immense cost. And if you talk to anyone who's involved in the City Rail Link, for example, at the moment, they will give you a pretty negative analysis of what's actually possible as far as putting that below ground, because that's been one of the largest projects that we have undertaken. But again, the evidence just doesn't really bear out that it makes sense for us to do effectively metro underground.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics. Like, ultimately, the yardsticks that politicians use to make these decisions are at present to kind of bind themselves in these merry-go-rounds of consultation and consultants' reports. So if we have the bold decision-making on the basis of what is best for the climate, best for our communities, fastest and most cost-effective to deliver, we can just get on with it.
And speaking about decision-making, I actually want to pivot into the council and the relationship with the council. So Auckland Mayor Wayne Brown sent out a manifesto to all political parties. In his manifesto, he outlined key priorities that he believes will be needed in order to help the city grow. So as part of this, he highlighted partnership and devolution, creating a fundamentally different relationship between Auckland Council and the government. He also highlighted social, cultural and economic development and a formal partnership to deliver and fund agreed priorities. Do you believe that the central government should be less involved in decision-making for Auckland? And if re-elected, how do you plan to work in tandem with the council?
I'm currently working in tandem with the council, actually, even with Mayor Wayne Brown. So it's funny, right? People look at who I am and the things that I advocate for. And I think one thing that all of us can say is that you'll never have to guess what me or the mayor, for different reasons, are thinking. We actually have a pretty constructive working relationship. So I will be really straight up with him about the things that I disagree on. And same goes with him. But where we can agree, we do move forward and we create really awesome opportunities for, I guess, progress on those issues. And here I could point to, for example, what we've managed to do with the Māori Wardens and CPNZ with the community hubs that are occurring to ensure kind of greater sense of safety and well-being and checking in on folks who, you know, may be struggling on the streets. Also with the likes of what's happening with the Portland, and that's something I've been advocating for since even Phil Goff was in office. So that constructive relationship already exists, but the resource sharing doesn't. And this has been reflected not only in the most recent local government, Future of Local Government review, but also in the Productivity Commission review of the Shannon Inquiry tabled in Parliament last year and the Shannon Inquiry 10, 15 years ago, all of which told us that we do not adequately resource local government to do the things that we mandate them to do under the Local Government Act 2002. And in a nutshell, the problem is that in the OECD, the average amount of spending that occurs proportional at a local and central level is 30% at local government. Here in Aotearoa, it's less than half of that at 11%. So we do have to find ways to do greater revenue sharing, otherwise the only major lever that councils can pull is rates. And understandably, given the current democratic deficit that we have at a local government level, the voices that are disproportionately heard are those who have a vested interest in the status quo and keeping rates as low as is possible. That doesn't benefit all of us who live in the city, and it definitely doesn't benefit the future of the city or get built the infrastructure that's so necessary for all of us.
I'm interested in revenue sharing because that's a topic that I don't think a lot of Aucklanders actually get into and have much idea of how the local government makes money. So you spoke about rates there, but are there any other ways that you'd be in favour of changing in order for the local government to get a bigger share of the revenue?
Yeah, so this is something which we contemplated in the midst of our campaigning against actually the austere budget proposals from Mayor Wayne Brown at the beginning of this year. And we did a huge amount of organising on that with local boards, with Taumata Toia Iwi, and with a bunch of others, CABs, who came to the table to say these cuts across the board are simply not serving our communities. And actually even talking to business associations, they were saying it's bad for business. And we ended up getting the largest ever number of submissions to an Auckland Council budget that we'd ever seen. I tried to engage Auckland-based MPs and Auckland electorate MPs, which is about a third of our parliament in this issue. None of them wanted to touch it. And this is the irony that I find, right, is that they are more than willing to say that they want local government to do X, Y, Z, but then when it comes to actually making that relationship work in practice, they don't want to touch it with a barge pole because it ends up being controversial and hard and difficult. But maybe that's politics. So what it actually looks like in practice is... So the point that I was making around Auckland Council budget is that we were looking at other levers that are available for Auckland Council to generate revenue. So rates is the main way, but we also have things like dog licensing fees, we have parking fines, we have, something which has been kind of gained relative cross-partisan consensus on congestion charging, for example. We also have the likes of the regional fuel tax. All of those are different levers which Auckland Council currently has, but there's been a really important point made actually by our current mayor, which is that Auckland Council doesn't even have the power to set its own parking fines. So we do need to enable greater empowerment of our local authorities, not the least our super city, which is responsible for a third of the population in this country, the ability to raise that revenue themselves. And that's what distributed decision-making looks like. Don't even get me started on the constitutional conversation, but in a nutshell, I do think that there is a problem with how our local government is presently a creature of legislation and can constantly have really core components of what it's supposed to do ripped out by oscillation of government. So a clear example of that is that with the former national government, they removed what are called the four wellbeings from the Local Government Act. When we came into power in 2017, we reinstated those, but obviously you would probably expect, given the kind of right-wing economic motivations of individualism and privatisation that, you know, are being trumpeted this election, that were we to have a National Act government, they would once again do exactly that and strip our cities of the arts, culture, vibrancy and community platforming.
I guess when we talk about local government, there's a low voter turnout, but then when general elections come around, there's a bit of a frenzy and everyone gets involved in it and it's excitement around it. So when I was growing up with my local MP, they were there for ribbon cuttings.
Yep.
And they were there when there was a photo opportunity. So I guess a lot of New Zealanders are disenfranchised with the idea of a local MP. And I just want to ask you, because you've had 3 years in the role, is there a particular project that you can point to that you go, this is what I did as a local MP, this is what... the kind of work that I want to do for you guys in the future?
100%. So one of the things that I'm proudest of is the mahi that I've done with Sunday Blessings. And I here want to shout out to Danielle Legale, who is one of the co-founders of the org. They've been operating out of Alan Melville for the past few years. And I first met them in 2020 at the Christmas celebration that they were having. Sunday Blessings is premised on providing at least one guaranteed hot meal, kai, for those who are experiencing, disproportionately those who are experiencing homelessness, but obviously you don't need to prove that when you come forward. And it happens every Sunday, as I was saying, out of Alan Melville. And when I first met them, Sunday Blessings, and started kind of volunteering and getting a sense of the organisation, I was like, this is an entity, a grassroots entity that is at the coalface of engaging with people who are so frequently written off by mainstream media and particularly by the kind of approach of legacy parties in our parliament that patronises and looks down on these people as opposed to understanding their experience and therefore the interventions that can provide us with an opportunity to improve those people's lives and in turn improve society and, I don't know, reduce crime and all of those other things that we ostensibly care about. And throughout the pandemic, and particularly the Omicron outbreak, I called up all of our different social services across the electorate just to understand who was at threat and what was vulnerable, especially if a team went down with sickness in a volunteer capacity. And we identified that Sunday Blessings might potentially fall over and not be able to do that food provision every Sunday. So working with Student Volunteer Army and Sunday Blessings, we established what we called initially the Omicron Resilience Team, and that was kind of a distributed organising model so that we had a secure team to be able to deliver that every single Sunday. On top of that, we then worked with Auckland Council to get them secure funding so that we had a part-time consistent organiser, and that turned into the base for what became our hub for civil defence and ensuring services and goods were available to people throughout Auckland Anniversary Flooding and Cyclone Gabriel. So we've created greater community resilience there with a project that originally came for and by the community and now has become kind of a PO or a stalwart within Auckland Central. And there's tons of pockets of kind of issues and entities like that that we've taken from that space of, you know, trying to figure out how to become sustainable, to ultimately become more sustainable and recognise as part of the civil defence infrastructure of this city and therefore this country.
And you touched on civil defence there and the anniversary floods, and I actually wanted to ask a question about climate resiliency. And in particular, I've asked every other candidate about infrastructure, but they've mainly pointed to other bigger, I guess, policies and ideas, which are also very important. But I know that you do a lot of research in this area. So I was asking them basically, is there any other cities around the world where you've seen infrastructure go in to make that city more climate resilient? And is there something that we can institute in Auckland Central?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to look at Singapore, for example, like the sponge cities are frequently invoked, but when in the wake of the floods hitting, I had the Honourable James Shaw, obviously co-leader and current Minister for Climate Change, in Tāmaki Makaurau, because I really wanted him to see firsthand what had occurred, but also to talk to people who had been impacted by a climate disaster. And Councillor Richard Hills, who's based up in the North Shore, took us to a recent development from Kianga Ora, where they'd worked in partnership with Mana Whenua and daylighted a stream. And an area that had previously always been inundated with flooding in state housing areas actually was one of the most climate resilient places within the entire city, that massively coped with the floodwaters and was able to re-divert the waters and otherwise away from housing and a new development, which was also density done well. So we have really local examples of this stuff as well. And I'd point to another awesome constituent called Mark Van Kartoven, who I've been working with in Freeman's Bay, who for the last 30 years has been planting out his property and his berm to demonstrate precisely what climate resilience looks like. It's literally a microclimate if you walk down there and through the planting that he's done on the berm. So while, you know, we see a lot of political parties, and particularly a lot of those in the commercial space internationally as well, pointing to the need for new innovation and technology in order to get us out of the climate crisis, the reality is the best invention that we have is trees. And we need to plant more trees. And what trees do are not only stymie the flow of water from the sky to the ground, but then their root systems and the kind of planting around that then helps to absorb in a far better manner than simply mowed lawns would. We know that as a result of the decision of the former ACT national government in about 15 years ago to remove urban tree protection from the Resource Management Act, that we've seen a decimation of urban tree canopy in Tāmaki Makaurau, something which the Honourable Eugenie Sage and myself fought really, really long for over the last 6 years was the reinstatement of that tree protection. We recently got through the process of the Natural and Built Environments legislation through Environment Select Committee a protection of and a requirement that there will be guidance for tree protection for local authorities. So that's finally something that we have managed to get back in there, despite the protestations not only of the right, but also sometimes of the Labour Party. So to me, it's just about that green infrastructure. You know, we can talk about how we have more permeable spaces, but the reality is when you cover an entire city in concrete, you are going to experience these issues. So I am supportive of the proposals that we've seen from Auckland Council with the likes of the Make Way for Water plan. But the question then becomes, how do we fund it? Which is related to your earlier question about that kind of relationship between local and central government. And the Greens have put forward a really sensible, I would say, policy proposition, which is to use the climate emergency response fund revenue raised from the emissions trading scheme and things that are actually climate action, unlike the National Party paying for generalised tax cuts with the ETS revenue. But that $750 million fund would go a hugely long way to building up our green infrastructure, which also has the co-benefit of making our cities more beautiful and improving people's mental health.
Yeah, and alongside mental health, I guess I want to pivot into another kind of topic now. And one of the biggest critiques of the Labour government past couple of years has been around the crime rate and the growing crime rate. And I guess in this electorate in particular, we've had instances of horrific and like horrible crime happen in the last year.
Yep.
So, you know, you've been the MP for this electorate for the past 3 years. How do we make Auckland City a safer place for the people that live here? Because that's a major concern.
Yeah, and you're right. And I just want to acknowledge, firstly, victims and survivors of crimes that have occurred, and to say that one of the most important things I think that politicians can do this election, with the context of concern about crime, is not to sell their constituents and the New Zealand public down the river by using rhetoric that they know enforces solutions that simply aren't solutions, things that will not work, that are actively anti-evidence. For example, ankle bracelets on kids, or, you know, longer prison sentences, when we know full well, and the evidence has been borne out and commissioned by successive governments to tell us that the longer people spend in prison, the more likely that they are to reoffend. So if we're to put under a microscope and to disaggregate all of those different instances of crime that you've alluded to, we have to be grown-ups and say that gun crime is a different thing to ram raids, is a different thing to antisocial behaviour, is a different thing to homelessness. But frequently in political rhetoric, all of those things are swept up together. So if we're going to be adults and we're going to separate those things out, and we're going to talk about gun crime, for example, I sat on the Specialist Select Committee in the wake of the Christchurch terrorist attack. And what we heard time and again is that had we acted faster in the 90s in the midst of the Aramoana mass shooting, then we would have had a gun registry back then. But politicians dragged their heels, and we ended up with a lobbying effort, which then saw that stymied. And I'll get these figures wrong, but they are general estimates. At that point in time, there are approximately 150,000 guns in the country. Now, there's around 1.5 million. And again, we're always going to be playing catch up unless we institute those requisite policies to control guns. So that's something which I've also heard in conversations with the police. We have to bring forward the compliance timeframe for the gun registry. So that's one component. Then when you're talking about ram raids, again, if we want to look at the research, what Police National Headquarters tells us, and this is research released, I think it was August last year, they looked at 80 to 85 of the most egregious youth offenders and found that 95% of those kids have been subject to family harm incident call-outs in the past 6 months alone. That should be an opportunity for intervention from the state to ensure that those kids have access to everything that they possibly need, because otherwise they are simply a statistic and they end up showing up as a worse statistic further down the track. And again, contextualise this in the reality that we know, as Sir Bill English said in 2011, that prison is a moral and fiscal failure. It costs us $193,000 a year to put somebody in a prison cell knowing that we're going to get worse outcomes at the end of it. If we invested just half of that in somebody's life when they first made contact with the criminal justice system, we would turn those lives around and we'd have far better outcomes instead of spending good money after bad for worse and worse outcomes. So this is where I think that it's also really critical that we reframe this conversation, particularly if we're talking about the city centre, and start talking about vibrancy. Because right now, what we know full well is that having places and spaces vacant, particularly our commercial retail properties, is that we breed an environment that people don't necessarily want to hang around. It's not well lit, and in turn that produces that kind of antisocial vibe. So how do you fix that? Well, we fill those spaces, and there's different opportunities to do that through, for example, vacancy rates, that if legislation were to empower local government to do that, we could get on with it. Through, for example, Eke Panuku and council using the properties that they hold in Midtown. If you're listening, council, get on with it. And to fill those out, to activate our food trucks and our buskers, and to bring that sense of vibrancy and in turn that surveillance effect, which means more eyes and ears on the street, which means things are safer. And another really key example of this is something that I worked with our police minister and with Auckland Council to deliver, is those hubs. So there's four hubs which will be operationalised by the end of October, which host Community Patrols New Zealand and our Māori wardens, and are a base for more foot patrols, but also interventions that might not necessarily be able to occur from the place of the police.
Well, I just finally wanted to ask you, if you are re-elected as the MP for Auckland Central, what is your vision in 3 years' time for this city, and how do you want your electorate to look after you, the three-year term is done?
So what I said in 2017 when I gave my maiden speech, which is a pretty cooked name for the first speech in Parliament, is that if I can do any one thing in my time in politics, it's to change people's perception of what politics is, because it's not, you know, Shakespearean soliloquies and politicians yelling back and forth at each other in Wellington. In fact, that's so disconnected from people's daily lives. Politics is just about power, it's about resources, and it's about decision making. So what I want to do more of is continuing to re-empower our communities and enable them to take back that power power to solve our own problems. Because the reality is, at the end of the day, whoever is in power, while we can siphon off and get more resourcing for our communities and for Auckland Central, proud here of the likes of the St. James, for example, and the work that we've done on increasing Hauraki Gulf protection, ultimately, Wellington's not going to solve our problems for us. We have to unify, mobilise and organise to create the mandate for those things in the first place. So while we've been confronted with relentless challenges over the last 3 years, not the least COVID-19, which dominated the first year and a half of my term and required a lot of responsive and proactive organising, we know that we have an incredible opportunity with the next 3 years, actually an imperative for the next 3 years, for us to do things in a way that is building an inclusive and climate resilient economy. And that means ensuring that everybody has what they need to get by, but also empowering everybody to engage as politically as is possible. So what I see kind of happening from a theory of change perspective is greater redistribution of that power and therefore that resource to our community organisations who are already doing the mahi. And I also want to see a change to our built environment. So I do want to see reallocation of road space. I want to see particularly our city centre return to vibrancy, but that's going to require a relationship with and constant negotiation and work with Auckland Council. And that's where I'd say, look at the candidates that have done the work in this space. And I think pretty clearly, I've hopefully demonstrated that.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.